April 11th, 2012, in Dublin. How to control the mind. Can you all see?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to be looking at what is the mind? How does it affect us? How do we control it? And what are the results and stages of controlling the mind? So what is the mind? So just like we have this gross body that's made up of muscles and bones and blood and skin, so our subtle body is also made up of something. I just like sometimes people can see ghosts. Right? And when they see the ghost, what does the ghost look like? Yeah, it looks like the person's body looked when they were alive. And what is, in other words, it has a form. The ghostly body has a form. And the ghostly body is made up of the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego. So that has a form. So what's it made out of? It's not made out of bones and blood and skin. It's made out of thoughts and desires. So whatever thoughts and feelings and desires we have, they're building our mind. Exactly like the kind of food you eat build your body. You know, is that still a little fuzzy?
A little bit.
Yeah, we could fix it so it's perfect. There, that's much better. Okay. Thank you. So just like, you know, these fingernails, they used to be chapatis and broccoli. And so in the same way, my mind is made up of whatever I'm thinking about. It's a material machine. The mind is not alive. We were talking yesterday comparing the mind to just like people have these plans they buy where they can get 500 TV stations and they can flip through, you know, watch this, what about this. So the mind is like that. The mind has like all these thousands and thousands of channels, and it's going through them saying, look at this, what about this, aren't you interested in this? Wouldn't you like to know more about this? Wouldn't you like to do this? Wouldn't you like to go there? What about this? Why don't you worry about this? Why don't you think about this? Why don't you get this? Look over here. You know, watch this show. So that's basically what it's doing as a material machine. That's its business. And by the way, we have this machine because we want to forget Krishna, and therefore Krishna gives us this forgetting him machine. See, forgetting Krishna is very difficult because he's everywhere and he's everything. Mayatatamidam sarvam jagadav yakti murtina matstani sarvabhutani nachaham te sarvastita. Krishna is everywhere. So how is it possible to imagine you're separate from him? You have to be distracted constantly. Because as soon as you're not distracted, then you'll understand that, oh, there's Krishna. So just like with a little child, she's a little too young for this, but when she gets a little older, you'll notice that, that's right, that one of the main ways that you deal with little children is you distract them. Those of you who are parents, you know that, right? The child's getting into some mischief, just, oh, look at this funny thing over here. And the child's distracted. So the mind is trying to distract us from the fact that Krishna is everywhere and in everything. Now, the mind is the master of the senses. The mind is sometimes called the chief sense. And in an ideal state, the mind is directing the senses, although sometimes some people have senses that are directing the mind. Now, the mind is what allows us to experience the body. It's like the interface to the gross body. It allows us to connect with the gross body. Actually, all sensations and all sense perception takes place within the mind. Just like our eyes, you know, we're seeing something, but that seeing is actually happening in the brain. It's not happening in the eyes. just like, you know, when we can have a dream or we can even imagine. We could do a little exercise right now, and I would say, you know, close your eyes. And now you don't even have to close your eyes. Everybody, just even with your eyes open, you can imagine an apple. You can see the apple in your mind, what to speak of if you closed your eyes. So how are we doing that? And we can, in a dream, without any contact with the outside world, we can experience everything we experience with our gross senses. You can eat and drink and run and so many things in your dreams. So what's really, the experience is actually happening in the mind. So here's a very nice illustration. Body as machine. And the soul and the super soul operating it, and the mechanism by which the soul is operating the machine is the mind. So that's what the mind is. It's a distraction machine. It's designed to, you know, forget about, here, forget, look at this, forget about God. Look at this, think about this, forget about God. Look at this, think about this, forget about God. And it allows us to enjoy the material world. Now, how does it affect us? Now, this is very important. This is the fall down sequence as described in the Bhagavad Gita toward the end of the second chapter. That the mind is putting so many things in front of us. Think about this, worry about this, want this, do this. And some of those we grab onto. You know, it's exactly like, you know, look at this movie, look at this movie, look at this movie. Oh, okay, I want to watch that one. And the person goes into the theater or switches to that channel and watches that one. And then they become involved, right? If you just see the advertisements, you don't become involved. But once you go into the theater and watch the movie, you become involved. So if there's some thought that the mind presents to us, that we start contemplating it. We start turning it over. We start thinking about all the permutations of it. We start associating with it. Sangat sanjayate kama. So by that association, we start getting desires. You know, as the person's reading the book or watching the movie, they start getting desires. They start caring. You start actually caring whether or not this imaginary character gets some imaginary goal. It starts to make a difference to you. Or you see this with people watching sports. You know, I've never been a watching sports person. Never. And I remember visiting a friend's home where their son was early 20s or something. He was watching a game, and he would jump out of his seat and yell at the television. So one develops intense desire. It starts to really matter to you whether the team wins or not, whether the hero gets killed or not. It starts becoming important to you. And then from there, anger. We talked about anger yesterday. Remember the three things with material desires? Either you, what? What was the first thing? Three options with all material desires. First thing is? No. With the game we played. First thing is you don't get them. Remember that? What was the second thing?
Even if you get them.
You get them and you're disappointed, not happy with them. And the third thing?
Even if you get satisfied, it's temporary.
Right. You get something, it's what you wanted, but it's temporary. And those are three causes of anger. I get angry when there's something I want that I can't get. I get angry when I get what I wanted and it's not what I expected. It's less than my expectations, and I get angry when I have the things that I want, but I lose them, or I'm afraid of losing them. And anger is very much wrapped up with fear. So the more that I think that something's really important, I have to have it. Kama. Kama means lust, but it means any great material desire. I have to have it. My team has to win. You know, the character in the movie, he has to come out victorious. As soon as you think that, then when things don't go your way, you become very angry. People become so angry at sporting events that they attack each other. Sometimes they even kill each other. You know, burn down things, isn't it? Why? Because they made it so important that their team wins. Is it important which team wins? I mean, no sane person would say that it makes the slightest bit of difference to anything or anybody. Except, I suppose, it makes more money for a few people or whatever. But it really is a very inconsequential thing. But just by thinking about it, by contemplating it, that when you think about something, it becomes important. And it becomes so important that if it doesn't happen, you become angry. Now, it's easy to see that, you know, who wins the hockey game or the football game or the cricket game is foolish. But everything we want in this world is foolish. Everything we think we have to have, a particular color paint in our bedroom wall or a particular size of shoe, or for my wife to deal with me in a particular way, or for my child to get a certain grade on their exam, or for me to get a particular job. I mean, if we really think about the sort of things that we really want and that we get very angry about when we don't get, people treating us with just common human decency, even. And we get so upset. Why are they treating me like some street dog that they're kicking? It's because we've contemplated something, and by contemplating it, we have become attached to it. Which, without contemplating it, we wouldn't have become attached to it. It wouldn't have had any meaning to us. We just let it go. And then from lust, anger arises from lust, bewilderment. From anger, rather, bewilderment. You know, when we get angry, we lose our sense. It's very difficult to keep your good sense when you're angry. It's possible, but it's extremely difficult. It requires a tremendous amount of self-control to keep your good sense when you're angry. So bewilderment of memory and illusion, and then falling into the material pool. The material pool is taking one birth after another to fulfill our desires. And that's what happens, that whatever we do in our life, whatever the mind's desires, will pull us to another body. Our attachments and our anger and our bewilderment, they pull us to another body, whatever we think about. So it's what we're thinking about, what we're contemplating, that's entangling us moment to moment to moment, and it was entangling us life after life after life. Yam yam bap bisram bhavam toja chante kalevram kam tame vaitikantaya sarapad bhava bhavita. So Krishna says the body we get in our next life, that's dependent on what we think about during our life, but particularly what we think about at death. So why particularly at death? Because that's a test. So I tell this story all the time, but it really made it very obvious to me that I was taking my students out on a field trip. And when we were coming back, we saw big billows of smoke in the sky. The whole sky was filled with black smoke. And the students said, you know, let's go see what it is. So we saw that there was an apartment complex that was on fire. And there was like 8 apartments. We couldn't get close for a long time. And finally the fire trucks came and put out the fire. The kids said, you know, let's go see. So we went, and there was this young woman, 20s, maybe early 30s. She was standing on the sidewalk barefoot and just with her 3 young children. So when the fire started, she grabbed her children. She didn't take her money. She didn't take her shoes. She didn't take her photo albums. She just took her children. So the time of death is like that. The house of the body is on fire, so to speak. And one mentally will try to grab whatever is the most important to us. So that we can say during our life, this is really important to me. This is what's really important to me. Just like you can tell in an organization what's really important. Well, how can you tell in an organization what's really important? How can you tell what the real priorities of an organization are?
It's getting praised all the time.
Oh, definitely. What gets praised? Who are the heroes? Who are the villains? What else? Oh, somebody who knows about organizational culture. I didn't expect such a sophisticated answer. By the budget. The main way you can tell what an organization's priorities are, what do they spend money on? And the same way we can say, you know, this is what I really care about, this is what I really care about. But what we really care about will be tested at the time of death. And with the time of death, whatever we've absorbed our mind in, whatever we've spent most of our mental money on, you can think of it just like each of us have a certain amount of money that we're destined to earn in our life. And what are we going to spend it on? Each of us have a certain amount of energy that we're going to have in our life. What are we going to spend it on? So what are we going to engage our machine in doing? So here you see, you know, if somebody acts like a dog, they become a dog. If they act like a hog, they become a hog. If they act like a celestial, they become a celestial. And if they act as a devotee of Krishna, then they go to the spiritual world. Okay, so Krishna explains that the mind is one of the sitting places of lust. And by lust, we don't just mean sexual desire. We mean any kind of strong material desire where we feel, I have to have it. I'm not going to take a no. I'm not going to accept a no. So when Arjuna asks Krishna, why do we sometimes do things that we don't even want to do? As if somebody else is forcing us. You ever wondered that? You know, I make a resolution, this is the kind of person I want to be, this is what I want to do, and then somehow we end up doing the opposite. Why is that? And I first read that, I was so fascinated. I was like, the edition of Bhagavad Gita I had, the answer was on the next page. So I read at the bottom of the page, by what is one compelled to act sinfully, as if engaged by force? I said, yes, I always wanted to know the answer to that question, you know. I turn the page and Krishna says it's lust. And I'm like, oh. And then Krishna talks about where lust is sitting. That's a useful thing to know. You want to know where your enemy is located. So in World War II, the Americans were fighting the Japanese in the Pacific Ocean. And the Japanese were winning and winning and winning and winning and winning. And the Japanese made a plan that they were really going to get rid of the Americans once and for all. They were going to knock out all of the aircraft carriers. You all know what an aircraft carrier is, right? One of those big flat boats that the airplanes take off of. Because when you're fighting a war in the ocean, you have to have a mobile airport. So they were going to lure the American aircraft carriers to Midway Island and destroy it, try to destroy all of them. So they had a plan that hinged on secrecy. But unknown to them, the Americans had broken their code. And the Japanese generals were talking, and one of them said, suppose our secrecy is broken. And the other general says, it's impossible. We're not even going to consider that. So they didn't. And the Americans knew that the Japanese were planning a trap at Midway, and so instead of the Japanese trapping the Americans trapped the Japanese. So when the Japanese went to do their ambush, they were ambushed. And the Japanese didn't know where the American boats were. So they were sending out bombs to the wrong places because they didn't know where their enemies were. And at one point they outfitted all their planes to bomb the island. And then when they started getting reports, the American ships are already here. How are the American ships here? They're not supposed to be here. How did they get here? Then they had to change to a different kind of bomb. And they were changing really quickly, and they left the bombs for the island on the top of the deck as they were switching. So when the American planes bombed the Japanese ships, it was really easy to blow them up because the bombs were all just sitting there. And instead of most of the American fleet getting destroyed, most of the Japanese fleet was destroyed, and that was the turning point of the war. From that point on, the Japanese were in retreat. But the main problem the Japanese had is that they didn't know where the Americans were. In fact, they bombed the same ship over and over again, thinking they had bombed four different ships because they couldn't recognize their enemy. So my point is you have to know where the enemy is. You have to know who they are and you have to know where they are. So the mind is one of the resting places of this intense, insatiable, have to have it at any cost, I don't get it, I'm going to get angry and lose my intelligence kind of material desire. And it also keeps all of our present and past desires, which Prabhupada says is giving us bodies one after another. And then the mind's business is also accepting and rejecting. The part of the subtle body called the intelligence makes plans, and then the mind, if things go well, the mind is supposed to accept or reject things in accord with that plan. Now you make a plan, I want to become a doctor, and then if somebody says, we're throwing a party tonight, the mind says, no, I have to reject that because the plan of the intelligence is to become a doctor, I can't go to the party, I have to study for my exams. So that's the business of the mind. Now, we've talked so far about how the mind can be an enemy, but the mind can also be a friend. And how can the mind be a friend? This question was asked by Maharaj Parikit to Sukadeva Goswami in the 10th canto. He said that the absolute truth is beyond the reach of the mind or the words or the senses. So how is that that we can engage, we can use the mind and the words and the senses to find the absolute truth? And different parts to the answer, but one part of it is that the mind is also Krishna's energy. Bhumirla panalo vayu kam mana buddhir eva cha. Mana. Mana means the mind. There's a very interesting section in the 10th canto where Krishna is instructing the gopis at Kurukshetra about how they can remain absorbed in thoughts of him. And Prabhupada explains there that the activities of the mind are also the energy of Krishna. And as long as you can think, you cannot be separated from Krishna. It's quite fascinating. And of course, Krishna also says, Matasmatir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. I am giving you your knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. Of course, why does Krishna give us a machine, this distraction machine? Again, because we wanted it. Just like the children may say, you know, I want, what are those video game machines? What are they called? Xbox, game boxes, Game Boys, Xboxes, whatever they are. I'm not, sorry, I'm probably saying something foolish. But anyway, some gizmo that allows you to, you know, the children, we want it, 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 we want it. And the parents may say, okay, here you go. So we're saying to Krishna, I want it, 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 I want it. Okay, here's your distraction machine. I want to forget about you, I want to forget about you, I want to forget about you. Okay, here you go. This distraction machine. And unfortunately, then when we want to remember Krishna, it's got very hard because now we have this distraction machine that we're living with, that we've become really addicted to. But the mind being also Krishna's energy, the mind can also be engaged to think about Krishna, in which case it becomes our friend. All right, we're going to look at controlling the mind and how to make the mind our friend. So to think of Krishna always. That would mean even when you're sleeping. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, for the beginner, at least to think of Krishna regularly. So if you can't think of Krishna all day long, which basically means there's not yet love awakened, then at least regularly. So at least to have some time every day, this is my time really to be with Krishna. I remember one time when my husband's business got very successful. And he said, you know, Armila, we're hardly spending any time anymore except when we go to the temple in the morning. So we scheduled a time. His business closed at 8 o'clock. So we scheduled a time from like 8:30 to 9:30. And he would only eat once a day. So I would serve him his dinner and he'd tell me what he did during the day. And we'd go to the post office. And it was really nice having that hour. Okay, this is just for my husband. The kids are in bed. I finished my chanting. You know, it's just a time to be with him. My father did that when I was very small. It started when I was 2 years old until I went to college when I was 17. So he'd be with me from about 5 or 5:30 in the morning until I went to school, or when I was very little until he went to work. And because of that, we had a very deep relationship. And what did he do? He played games with me when I was a little kid, and we would just talk together and look at books together, and he'd make my breakfast. I mean, making my breakfast meant that he would put some cereal in a bowl and put some honey in it, you know, toast some bread. He used to make fresh orange juice every day. We had this orange juice squeezer, and he would put the oranges, make the orange juice. And we would just be together. And just from that time together, we became very close. Just because my father did that, pretty much anything my father asked me to do, I would do. When I was 3 years old, my father said, don't ever smoke. And I never, even though 90% of the kids in my secondary school smoked, I never smoked, just out of respect for my father. Fortunately, when I wanted to join the Hare Krishna movement, my father was supportive. If he hadn't been, I don't know if I could have come. My mother was not. But my mother had not spent that kind of time with me. So some time with Krishna every day. Now, we talk about in modern society having quality time, but it doesn't really work like that. The way you have quality time with someone is you have quantity time with somebody. You put in time regularly. Or I remember one time in our school, we had some students who lived with our family to go to our school. And it was about a year when we had every afternoon a half an hour when everybody in the house needed to read a spiritual book. It could be any of the Krishna conscious books, didn't matter. No talking, no nothing else. We would just read for that half an hour. It was so nice. You know, then everybody had that time to read. So to make some set time, okay, this is when I'm going to be with Krishna. To chant Hare Krishna on beads or singing, to read the books, to worship the deity. This is my time just to be with Krishna. And to spend that time actually thinking about Krishna, not going through things as a ritual. Not just like, okay, Hare Krishna. Years ago, someone asked me, how can I think of Krishna at work? I said, well, first, why don't you start thinking about Krishna when you're chanting? So have some time. Can you imagine if you had, you know, an hour a day to spend with your husband or wife, and that whole time all you were doing was, you know, talking on your phone? Of course, we didn't have mobile phones back then. But how rude that would be, right? This is my time with you, and now I'm going to do something else with it. It would be insulting. So always think of Krishna. We could also talk about how to think of Krishna all day, but at least some time. And then engage our senses in some practical service. So this is very easy for most people, I think easier than thinking about Krishna, is do something to help with the mission of Krishna consciousness. I mean, one thing that we're very fortunate about that Srila Prabhupada's given us is so many ways of practically engaging our senses in Krishna service. You know, if there's deities and there's making flower garlands for the deities and dressing the deities and cooking for the deities and cleaning the temple and fixing up the temple and putting on a festival and advertising the festival and printing books and writing books and distributing books and making films about Krishna. I mean, it can go on and on and on and on and on. Prabhupada said Krishna is not narrow or stereotyped, practically speaking, with a few exceptions. Anything that you're good at and anything you like to do. I mean, if you like to sell liquor or you like to murder people, that's not going to work out. But, you know, pretty much anything that you like to do and you're good at, you can do in Krishna's service. And then why does that help make the mind our friend? Any thoughts as to why doing practical service makes the mind our friend?
Because we feel satisfied.
Yes. Yes, we'll feel satisfied. And also remember that thinking, feeling, and willing are an integrated system. I tend to think about what I do. So you can go right to the mind and say, okay, I'm going to think about Krishna, then you're going to tend to do service to Krishna, and if you do service to Krishna, you're going to tend to think about what you're doing. Naturally. Right? If you're making a poster for Krishna to advertise something at the temple, you're going to think about it. What colors should I use? Well, maybe I should do this. Maybe I should do it that way. And then instead of thinking about, you know, who's going to win the football game or who the latest political leader is or something like that, you're going to think about your service. And then, of course, to chant Hare Krishna. To chant Hare Krishna with care and attention. With care and attention. And when we chant Hare Krishna, we should naturally think about Krishna's form, qualities, and pastimes. That should naturally come to us. Just like if I say, my mother, I naturally remember her face. And I remember what she does, or did. She's not with us anymore. But I naturally think about her just by saying, my mother. So in the same way, as soon as one says, Hare Krishna, one should immediately remember the form of the deity and the pastimes of the Lord. It shouldn't be just some empty ritual. And thinking about spreading Krishna consciousness mission, I mean, this is also a great benediction that we have, because teaching other people about Krishna is practically unlimited with the number of things you can do and the number of things you can think about and how you can engage your mind. And of course, it's very interesting. The same process that bewilders us, where we meditate on something materially, we become very attached to it, we have to have it, and we become angry, and we become bewildered. A very similar process exists in terms of thinking about Krishna. If I'm really absorbed that I have to do this for Krishna, I have to think about that, then I become attached to Krishna. Then, of course, instead of becoming angry and bewildered, I become peaceful and blissful. And especially to think about Krishna's activities, Krishna's pastimes. So here we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu chanting Hare Krishna in the forest outside of Vrindavan. And he was such an incredible kirtan leader. You know, we have wonderful kirtan leaders. But the kirtan leaders generally notice that there's some people not chanting. Or some people not chanting enthusiastically. Some people are, you know, checking their email on their little devices or whatever. Looking out the window or thinking about some argument they have with somebody today. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was such a great kirtan leader that the animals were chanting. And not only were the animals chanting, but the deer and the tigers were dancing with each other. And you can see they were hugging, instead of even kissing, they were hugging and kissing and dancing with each other. And they were all chanting Hare Krishna. Now this is a very interesting statement Srila Prabhupada makes. He says, the Vedic literatures contain many narrations of the Lord's pastimes, including the Battle of Kurukshetra and historical facts relating to the life and precepts of devotees like Prahlad Maharaj, Dhruva Maharaj, and Ambarish Maharaj. One need only concentrate his mind on one such narration and become always absorbed in its thought. Then he will be in samadhi. We're going to discuss a little bit more what samadhi is very soon. Samadhi is not an artificial bodily state. It is the state achieved when the mind is virtually absorbed in thoughts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here Prabhupada is saying, you can pick one story about Krishna or Krishna's devotees that you really like. And you can absorb your mind even in that one story. You don't even have to know all of the stories. So here's an example. Right? Here's Krishna killing a big, bad, magical demon. I'm not even sure which one of them that is. I think that's Vyomasura. Oh, and here's Krishna and Balaram feeding butter to the monkeys. Right? Mother Yasoda would spend all this time making butter for Krishna, for Krishna's pleasure. And Krishna did find pleasure in the butter, but he found pleasure by feeding it to the monkeys. His mother would get upset. I wanted that butter to cook for you. We could also worship the deities and think about the deities. Prabhupada said that one of the purposes of worshiping the deities is so that all day long we can think about, oh, how are the deities dressed? What do the deities look like? How can I get something for the deities? How can I get flowers for the deities? How can I get something nice for the deities? And we can think about the philosophy. And practically anywhere you go, anything you do, you can think about, oh, I can see how the philosophy is true in this circumstance. I can see how it's true in this circumstance. I can see how the three modes of material nature are working. I can see how people are overcome by the lust, anger, envy, greed, and illusion, and therefore losing their intelligence. Or I can see how people, by thinking about Krishna, become purified. All right, now we're going to look at what's the result of controlling the mind. And we're going to look at the stages of controlling the mind, as explained in the Nectar of Instruction, Text 8. So what's the result of controlling the mind? Well, Prabhupada says that real liberation from the material world means to be liberated from the subtle body. To be liberated from the gross body doesn't do you any good. You just have to take another one. You know, people who think, well, I'm going to get free of my troubles by suicide. Or finally, when I die, then I'll be free of my troubles. That's not a fact. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you simply get another body. That's not how one becomes free. Because what's giving us this gross body is the desires that we're accumulating in the mind. I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. Really, this gross body is fitting on top of my mind. Just like I buy clothes, I'm buying this jacket. I buy a jacket that fits my body. I'm not going to buy some humongous one or a little child's one. I buy something that fits me, and then I buy some style that I like. Something that fits the shape of my body, something that fits my desires. So in the same way, this gross body we have is fitting on top of our mind. What I want, what I like. Sometimes you see people who look like their dogs, right? Sometimes they even have contests who can look the most like their dog. I remember I once met this woman who I'd never met before. As soon as I met her, I said, oh, you must be so-and-so's wife, because she looked just like him. Sometimes you see that also after people are married for 10, 20 years. They may start to look like each other. That the body changes according to the mind. I remember one time going shopping and the lady in front of me in line, she looked like an African warthog. She really did. I thought, wow, you know, that's her next body. Of course, in our modern society, people try to look like animals. Some people. I remember in London seeing this one woman who had cut her hair very short and dyed it yellow with brown spots on it like a leopard. She was sitting in Soho Square, and I thought, okay, she's already preparing for her next body. I saw somebody else walking down the street. They had their cheeks pierced, and they had silver fangs coming out of their cheeks. So if you just get rid of the body, but you still have the mind, then you get another body to fit the mind. So real liberation is when there's no more material thoughts and desires. If there's no more material thoughts and desires, then this subtle body dissolves. One way I like to think about it, you know the little paper packets of seeds that you can buy in the shop? Suppose you took that whole packet and put it in a... You didn't open it, just took the packet unopened and put it in a container of water. So the water would dissolve the packet and sprout the seeds. So that's what bhakti's doing, is dissolving the subtle body, the material subtle body, and it's growing the actual spiritual body of the self, which has its own spiritual mind. So we attain our true self. This is a picture of Ajamil attaining his spiritual form and going to Vaikuntha. So our real self awakens when unfettered by the mind. Okay, we're going to look at stages of controlling the mind. So the first stage is called Shravanadash. And this is really the beginning stage of bhakti, where we're hearing, and the idea is to hear constantly. And that doesn't mean that you're always in a class or you always have some, you know, player plugged into your ears. But as far as possible, to be absorbed in reading and hearing and discussing about Krishna's name, fame, qualities, and pastimes. To be just filling the mind, filling the mind, filling the mind. Basically what we're doing then is it's just like if you had a handful of plastic pearls, okay? Your hand's all full of plastic pearls. And you want it, you take a real pearl and you put it in your hand, it knocks out a plastic pearl. Pretty soon your hand's all full of real pearls. So as you think about Krishna, you're pushing out the material thoughts. So this is what it starts with, as far as possible, hearing about Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. And thinking about them throughout the day to make an effort. It does take some effort in the beginning. Think about how Krishna's dancing on the heads of the Kaliya serpent. Right, how he's feeding the monkeys by Mother Yasoda, how he has three lines on his neck and three lines on his belly, and how he's got ankle bells on, how he's got the mark of the goddess of fortune on his chest, how he's very soft, how he likes to play his flute, how he likes to dress very nicely, even before he kills a demon, you know, he tightens his belt and puts his curls up in his turban, makes sure that he looks really first class. In fact, he always looks like he's about to go on stage. He always looks like he's about to do a performance. How Krishna comes and rescues Rukmini. Right? Rukmini was going to be married off to Shishupal. Save me! And he comes and he saves the damsel in distress. He does that a lot. Right? And how he destroys wicked persons. And so many things. So make an effort to think like that. That's the first stage. Now, after doing that for some time, remember, whatever we think about, what happens to anything that we think about? We become attached. So the next stage is one starts to accept it. There starts to be some acceptance. It's no longer the. It becomes more part of you. That this is what I'm doing. I'm spending time thinking of Krishna. Becomes really a part of your life. Now at this point, when it's starting to have some spontaneous attraction, when at this point has a lot of faith that yes, I want to fall in love with Krishna, Krishna is the goal of life, and one has the beginning of what Rupa Goswami calls spiritual greed, which would be the equivalent of material lust. So that's just beginning. By thinking about, we develop attachment. By attachment, lust. Lust, again, means a desire that you're not willing to give up. You know, materially speaking, when a person lusts after something, they'll do rather foolish things even to get it, won't they? Right? We see people who ruin their lives over an intense desire for fame or sex or money. You know, I think about our former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Now, he's president of the United States, which is still, I don't know how long it will be, but still the most powerful country in the world. And you've got that position, and you're going to throw it away to have some affair with some intern. Madness. So something that you want so intensely. So that also should happen with Krishna, that you want Krishna so intensely. So here it's just, we're starting to get that attachment. It's frail, it's not solid, but it's starting because I've started to really accept in the mind. This is all still happening in the mind. Started to accept within the mind that yes, I really like to think about Krishna. I really like Krishna. He's really wonderful. I really want a relationship with him. I really want to fall in love with him. So one is now meditating on Krishna, but it's very unsystematic. Sometimes you're meditating on Krishna, sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're meditating on this pastime, sometimes not this pastime, sometimes this quality. And it's very mixed up with material things. Now this is a very important point. The philosophy of bhakti yoga is not that first you become completely purified and then you can think of Krishna. It's not bhakti. It's a yoga ladder. It's not bhakti. As we see here, even the first stage, we're thinking about Krishna. Even in the beginning, where there's no real attachment, there's no real desire, one's still very much materially affected. In this stage, we're starting to think about Krishna, his name, form, qualities, and pastimes. So here, one's still very much materially conditioned. One is not, at this point, liberated. But one is starting to get some real attachment to Krishna. To Krishna, the person. Not just some real attachment to the mission or some real attachment to the institution, all of which may be lovely, but to Krishna. Actually Krishna, the person Krishna. Okay, now the third stage of controlling the mind has five parts to it. So there's five parts in the process of bringing the mind under control, and this middle part has five parts. So five parts, and the middle part has five parts. So first we're going to look at this middle part overall. And here it's called chanting in ecstasy, or smarana. Smarana means remembering. So in order to come to this stage requires a lot of determination and submission. And at this point, a person gets some idea of who they are. And that may even happen earlier. Krishna's independent. He can do what he likes. But certainly at this point, one starts to get an idea generally, and it can also happen later, of who one is. Cheta darpana marjanam, the mirror of the heart starts becoming cleansed. You know, you now have so many real pearls in your hand that you're starting to actually have reality. You're starting to really deal with reality. You've cleaned so much of the dirt from your mirror that you're starting to see something of yourself. You have some idea. Oh, I have this relationship with Krishna. I have that relationship with Krishna. There's a sense of it. And this I really would recommend this verse in purport also if you're interested in this topic. 328.34. So I recommend Nectar of Instruction, text 8, and Bhagavatam 328.34. And here Prabhupada's saying that in the beginning, the mind is employed in attracting the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the verse, Kapiladev says, you're attracting him like a hook is attracting a fish. So in this stage of controlling the mind, you're thinking of Krishna more deeply and Krishna becomes interested. There's a nice song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Mana Mana Mandire. He says, my mind is like a temple. Please, Krishna, you come into my mind temple. Come into my mind temple, and I will offer you garlands. I will offer you sandalwood paste. I will offer you arti with the light of my love. And what is my qualification? That in life or in death, I'm always worshiping you. So please come. And please come stay in my mind. So that's at this stage where the devotee is preparing their mind and they're absorbing their mind more and more in Krishna to attract him to come and sit there. So this is stage one of part three. Use the same terminology I have up on the wall. Part one of stage three. Part one of stage three. Stage three. One, two, three, four, five. Stage three is in five parts. This is part one. This is recollection, interrupted recollection. So it's not systematic. So a person will remember one pastime, then another. Now the difference between this and earlier unsystematic is here there's really some level of deep interest. And what a person's doing here, they may have some sense that I'm a cowherd boy, I'm one of Krishna's parents, I'm one of Krishna's gopis, but they're not really working on cultivating that relationship with Krishna at this point. What they're really working on is cultivating their attachment for Krishna, and they're cultivating that eagerness, which Rupa Goswami also calls spiritual greed, that eagerness for perfection, that desire for perfection. In the beginning of bhakti yoga, one may think one has a desire for perfection, but generally in the beginning, one has a desire for liberation or for heavenly enjoyment. One is thinking, if I go to Goloka Vrindavan, it'll be really heavenly there. Or, you know, I won't suffer anymore. I won't have to deal with my aching back or my yelling mother-in-law or whatever, you know, my boss I don't like or the leaky plumbing in the basement, whatever it is that we want liberation from. So gradually, by this stage, one is starting to really cultivate a desire for love. One starts becoming interested, really interested, in loving Krishna. And that's what one's working on at this stage. This is all still in the mind. This is all still in the mind. This is all still in the mind. It's all still material. Okay, part two of the third stage is now one's mental absorption is uninterrupted. And one is remembering Krishna's pastimes. Krishna has two particular kind of pastimes. He has his occasional and his eternal pastimes. Both of them are eternal in one sense. The occasional is what's displayed in the material world, where Krishna is killing the bad guys and things like that. And the other is in the spiritual world, where it's divided into eight parts of the day. So one is remembering these pastimes now in order. One is flowing into another, into another, into another, and one is absorbed without interruption. Now, who here has made real burfi? Anybody here cooked real burfi? Anybody? Not very many. All right, so the way you cook real burfi is you take milk, you boil it, and you've got to stir it. Now, at first, what you do is you boil it, then you turn down the flame, so it's boiling on its own. And you stir it occasionally. When it starts to get thicker, you have to stir it all the time or else it will burn. It will stick and burn. But it's still liquid. You've all eaten burfi, right? I assume that. Okay, if you haven't, it's like fudge. So it's still quite liquidy. So you're stirring it all the time now, but it's still liquid. So that's what this stage is. At this stage now, you're stirring all the time. You're constantly thinking of Krishna's pastimes all the time. But it's still very liquid. It's just that it's not interrupted. All right, now it starts becoming concentrated. So in terms of making burfi, it's become what we call condensed milk. You can buy cans of that in the shop. You know, sweetened condensed milk. And that's you could call that a finished preparation, you know. But here it's not. Now at this point, one mentally enters into the pastimes. So instead of just observing them, one enters into them. This is still on the platform of the mind. This is not spiritual at this point. Okay, we're still, where did I put my tissue? So this is still using the mind as a hook. As Kapila Dev says. So you might say, well, I thought it was already constant, but now it's becoming very, very concentrated. Now it's becoming very, very deep. That one is really aware of Krishna all the time and starting to become really aware of one's place in Krishna's pastimes. And then now this is a very interesting point. Part 5 of stage 3 is called samadhi, or a spiritual trance. But this is with the mind. And in that same purport, Prabhupada says this is lifeless yoga. It's done by determination. But at this point, the person who's in this samadhi, they're feeling that they're smelling the Jamuna River and they're seeing the detailed embroidery on Radharani Sari, and they've really felt that they've entered into the pastimes of Krishna. But this is still within the platform of the mind. Then the fourth stage is also called samadhi. Now this is interesting, isn't it? Part 5 of the third stage is called samadhi, and the fourth stage is also called samadhi. But this is a very different samadhi. This samadhi is when Krishna has become attracted and he enters into the heart, or he reveals himself in the heart of the devotee. Now it's not that the mental turns into the spiritual. The mental, as Lord Kapila Dev says, attracts the spiritual. So at this point, Krishna reveals himself in the heart along with the spiritual form of ourselves. That becomes visible. The mirror is now cleaned and one can see oneself, generally gradually. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about 11 components of the self: our name, our form, our age, where we live, and so forth and so on. And now one has what Prabhupada refers to as spiritual television in the heart. Just like right now in this room, there's television waves going through the room. But because we don't have a television set here, we can't see them. But if we brought in the right set and we tuned it to the right station, we could see them. So at this point, one is purified enough so that Krishna in the heart becomes revealed to one. One actually sees Krishna's pastimes, and one can see Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan or in Dwarka or Ramlila or any incarnation of Krishna. And one is actually seeing the real pastimes. So at this point, one's living in the world. At the same time, one's engaging in a spiritual body in perfection. One's living a real double life at this point. Which, again, we have some idea of that. Maybe some of you in this room are totally thinking about something else. Right? We all know how to do that. We all know how to be in one place and thinking about something else and not really being there. And if you're really good at it, I think many of us probably learned how to be really good at this in school. If you're really good at it, you can still function quite well in your external environment. You know, you can answer all the questions and fill out the exam when actually you're absorbed in something else. Okay, here again from that same purport, where Prabhupada says, in the beginning, the mind is employed in attracting the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the higher stages, there is no question of using the mind. And Prabhupada talks about lifeless yoga and living yoga. So in the second kind of samadhi, this is living yoga, where factually the Lord himself and we factually, not in a mentally constructed body, are really existing within the heart. Then the fifth stage So at this stage, Radha and Krishna are no longer just manifesting in the heart, but they manifest to one's external vision. And now instead of living in the world, but engaging in a spiritual body, one lives in the spiritual world, and one may still operate in one's material body for the sake of benedicting the people in general. So we have an example of this in the Bhagavatam. There's many, but this is one with Dhruva, where he was absorbed in seeing the Lord in the heart, and then his meditation broke, and then he saw the Lord standing before him just as he had seen him in the heart. Here he sees the Lord in front of him after he had seen him in the heart. Okay, so just a little review. The mind is something material, the form of our desires and thoughts and determination. It actually is a servant. It's a machine. It doesn't have any will of its own. It's not alive. And the mind takes us to our next body. It can be our friend or our enemy. And we control our mind by positive action that attracts Krishna. And this is, of course, the essence of bhakti yoga, to always think of Krishna, become my devotee as active service, worship as active service, offer homage unto me. So three active things, and one with the mind. Okay. So I don't want to stay quite as late today. Can you turn on the light? So, questions? Comments? Mobile phones are fine. I don't mind mobile phones as long as the music on the phone has to match the mood of whatever we're talking about. As long as you can coordinate it. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Not a question, but just a statement about the mind, the size of the soul. The size of the soul is describing what sort of thing. If you took a piece of hair, one millimeter of the hair, and we divide that hair into 1,000 parts, that would be the sum total of the size of the head of the other part of the soul. And another one is, we will see the soul and the super soul are in the heart. The heart is surrounded by a chamber called the pericardium. And my belief is that the soul and the super soul are in the pericardium. And not in the heart, it's a covering of the heart.
I really don't know.
And the reason being that if you do a heart transplant, the soul, which is in the outer covering, which is the pericardium, that's not removed.
Well, Prabhupada talked about with the heart transplant, just like you can stand up out of your seat and someone can bring another seat and then you can sit down there. But see, the soul doesn't stay with the physical heart. Because when death occurs, the soul doesn't stay in the dead body. That's what death means. The soul leaves that body.
Yes.
So the soul is actually in the riding in the subtle heart rather than in the gross heart.
In a dead body, right? You have a fresh case of an accident and organs are used for transplant. The heart is taken. We know that the soul is gone. In that body, the soul is gone. But the heart is being transplanted to a living person who's already on the table waiting for the transplant.
Yes.
So his soul and super soul are still with him. And the heart continues to work. And they survive and they live for many years.
Yes. My understanding is that the soul is actually the soul is not touching either the subtle or the gross body. But the soul is in the subtle body, in the heart. In the subtle body also has chakras and nadis, and the subtle body has a heart. There's a chakra in the heart of the subtle body.
Yeah.
And that roughly corresponds to the physical heart.
The third thing is about NDE. And my right heart operation in December 1991 experienced NDE during surgery.
Interesting.
She was able, afterwards she recounted everything when she came home.
Mm-hmm.
But the soul left and was looking down at the people trying to survive,
revive her.
Having
yeah.
massage and the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me that she concentrated very hard, possibly in the mind, and that the soul returned to her body. And there's a very good article on NDE in one of the Back to God, I think it's about 10 months ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That, and they gave various examples.
Yes.
But she's a...
She's an example of that.
Yeah,
yes.
She's, that's 20 years ago now.
Yes.
Mr. McGon is 20 years ago. Yes. Still alive.
Yes, that's fat. There's quite a number of fascinating stories of persons who in various circumstances will travel in there. And they're in the subtle body. They're not out of the subtle body. But they're traveling in the subtle body.
And mainly NDE is experienced by people either who have had surgical trauma or...
Some accident or something
accident,
like that.
Which is trauma of a different... So,
yes.
Because surgery is trauma.
Yes. And there's all different levels of them. Some of them just hover by the ceiling, and some of them go to some
yes.
other realms. And
yes, that's right.
It's definitely quite fascinating topic.
Yeah. And just one last
thing. Yes.
I think scientists have tried to capture the soul, but they failed to do so.
That's not very surprising.
Yeah. I didn't hear that.
That the scientists they've tried to capture the soul, but they failed. Yes.
The modern scientists, you know. And they put this person who was about to die in a glass case. And when the soul was about to leave the body, the glass case burst open. And
But I don't think the soul needs to break the glass case to get
yeah.
out of there.
Yeah. Okay.
To get out.
Right. Okay. But they tried to.
They tried to capture the
capture
soul.
The
huh?
soul, but they. To
what to do? Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I do find that those stories of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, they're as empirically verifiable as anything else. And it's as any other human testimony. Sometimes the person in their subtle body, you know, they're hovering near the ceiling, and they can see a sticker on the top of the light fixture that's not visible from the bottom of the room. In other words, they're able to give empirically verifiable information that they could only have given if they were floating around by the ceiling or they were going into other rooms. And yet people will say, oh, it's a hallucination or it's this or that, and there were no brain waves and there was no heartbeats. And you know, it's pretty hard to say that we're only the body in the face of so much evidence from so many people. And many people who didn't even have any kind of concept of being different from the body before having such experiences. Yes?
I was just going to add to that. There are examples of people who are born blind, and they come out of the body at a certain
and they can see.
Near death experience, and then they can see.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm just reading a book about astral travel, William Bowman, and it's quite fascinating. So he's consciously... want to create this experience out of body, and like a lot of people, like thousands and thousands of people are using his technique to do the astral travel, and just to this there are paralyzed people who are experiencing body movement through this astral travel, because when you're out of your body, you can move.
Exactly, yes.
So it's quite fascinating.
The body, we think of the body as facilitating us, but actually the body's limiting us.
Yeah.
So even just the subtle body has far less limitations than the gross body. Prabhupada talked about, you know, like if you're wearing gloves, how much can you enjoy touch when you're wearing gloves? If you want to enjoy the sense of touch, you have to take your gloves off. So this body's like a, you know, this big, heavy, like wearing a big space suit or something. And it's limiting our ability to see and hear and touch and everything. And even the subtle body is a limitation on the soul.
Just one more point.
Yes.
You've given thousands and thousands of lectures.
Probably.
Over the years.
We stopped counting a while
Which
ago.
Which would you consider the most daunting one in your life?
The most difficult one to give? Why are you asking this question? I remember years ago I was at the Japa retreat in Varshana. I was staying with a few other ladies and they said, "Can you tell us about when you had a spiritual crisis?" And you know, I didn't want to, but afterwards I did, and I said, "That's really depressing conversation. What was the most daunting?" You really want to, what will you do with the information?
My legal speech.
The reason why I asked this question is in September-October issue of Dr. Dodd, 2008, you left by train with a few other people to go to a village school.
With it, for deaf children.
With deaf children.
Yes.
And you were sitting, there's a picture of yourself sitting with a headmaster who was the interpreter.
Yes,
and
yes.
was supposed to be well-educated in sign language, which he learned of the different sign languages of the world.
Yes.
And you kind of had to do your part, and then he had to show the signs.
Yes.
And I thought that that was...
It was definitely very interesting, because usually when lectures are translated,
yes.
people can look at you while they're listening to the translators, because 70% of communication is body language, 23% is tone of voice, and 7% is words. So even when a lecture is being translated, people can get your body language and your tone of voice. And if the language has some similarity to English, which most do, unless you're like Chinese or Russian, then they're picking up some of the words also.
Yes.
But when it was sign language, everyone had to just look at the translator. It was as if I might have been in another universe.
Exactly.
You know, that was definitely a challenge. No, my most challenging class that I ever gave was when it was in Germany in the late 90s, and it was a meeting of about 30, 35 of the top educators in the movement, and many of the leading scholars and most senior persons were there. And I was asked with 10 minutes notice to give the morning class. And when I looked at the verse and the purport, it was one of those verses and purports that you read and you say, "I don't understand this and someday I'll figure it out." Was one of those. It was one of those that I had never been able to understand. And there it was. And I had 10 minutes to prepare. And I was speaking in front of people like Ridhananda Maharaj and Tamal Krishna Maharaj and a whole room of people like that. So that was my most difficult class. I had to change all of my clothes after the class because I sweat so much. Seriously. And I had to put my hands down on the lectern like this to keep them shaking. So that was my most difficult class. But you want to know what was funny about that class? You want to know what was funny? So at the end of I gave my best explanation I could. I gave about five different possible explanations. And at the end of the class, I said, "You know, I really am not sure. If anybody here has any other way of explaining this, you know, I'd be very grateful to hear from you." Nobody said anything. I felt very happy. I thought, well, they don't know either. That was my most daunting class.
Just one other part. There are articles in the Dr. Goddard you would not find in the standard Hare Krishna books. That's why I encouraged my audience here to make sure that the Bible actually got
it. It sounds like the Godhead.
All right, well, I'll tell you, I've been an associate editor of Back to Godhead since 1990, and I agree. Bye, Back to Godhead. I mean, you know, every once in a while when I go places, people say, "Oh, I used to read, you know, you used to write for Back to Godhead." I say, "I still do." And then they'll say, "Oh, well, I haven't gotten an issue for the last 10 years. I said, "Well, I'm still writing for Back to Godhead."
Well, I'm responsible for being, I'm the fundraiser of the temple. And I sell 40 Back to Godhead per 2 months.
Ah, very nice. Anyway, so yes, please buy Back to Godhead.
Yes, I believe, and I have every issue from 2008.
November 2006.
Well, I have every issue from like 1972 or 3. So if we're going to have a competition here. But all mine are now in my daughter's house in India. And I think the class I enjoyed giving the most was I gave a class three times to Christian ministers who were getting their master's degree. People were already Christian ministers, and they were in a seminary to get a master's degree in theology. Part of their study, they had to study world religions, and you knew that they were studying about religions for the purpose of defeating the religions. You knew that that's why they were taking the courses, because they were going to go out and be missionaries in different parts of the world, and they had to get those people to convert to Christianity. And they're very, very, most of them, obviously, not all of them, were very deeply devoted to Christianity and very knowledgeable in the Bible. So the first time that I gave class, it was a last-minute notice that our GBC, who presented the lecture every year, his father had just died, and so I had to be pulled in at the last minute. And then I did that for the next 2 years. Their professor has written a book about various religions, and he included a section on the Hare Krishna movement, and it's such a nice section. You would think that a devotee wrote it. It was just so well written. And this was in the American Southeast, which is what we call the Bible Belt. So if you know, like, the born-again Protestants, you've met born-again Protestants. They're the guys who distribute. Yeah, but they're more than just... They distribute little tracts on how all the Catholics are going to hell, those sort of people, you know? So, yeah, you met these guys. The vegetarians are going to hell. So those were the people that I was preaching to. And I'd say that I enjoyed those three classes the most of any lecture that I've ever given. We had such a wonderful rapport. I remember the second time, the first and third time they came to the temple, the second time we came to the seminary, and the second, third time I had more notice, and I brought my students with me. I brought my secondary students. And at least the second time at the seminary, the students did a kirtan, and they were all of the Christian minister seminary students were singing with us. It was just wonderful. And at the end of the talk, they were talking to a lot of the students about Krishna consciousness, not just to me, but it was an incredible sense of yoga with Krishna and with the persons there.
Were they not going to use that information to go out and try and defeat Krishna consciousness, maybe?
Well, perhaps. My goal was to get them to respect Krishna consciousness. That was my goal. And I focused on areas of similarity rather than areas of difference. There were certain things I just didn't talk about at all. They're all Protestants. I didn't talk about deity worship, for example. I didn't talk about reincarnation. I talked about how we also believe in being saved through faith and mercy, not just through works, kind of thing. And how the goal of life is love of God and things of that nature. But my goal was to get them to have some respect that these are also people like us who have some genuine interest in religion. Now, the other way, the time when I saw my Gurukul students most absorbed, what did they say, pin drop silence, was when one initiated devotee who's also a Christian monk who lives in a Christian monastery in Australia came to speak to the students about his experience.
Brother Albert.
Yes, and I've never seen this. I've never seen, you know, children, even 5-6-year-old children, that incredibly attentive for the whole time that he was talking. Happy noises are fun. It's going to be me 50 years from now. I want to see if anybody else has anything to say, if that's all right. Okay. Is there anybody else who has anything to say? Anything they'd like to bring up? Yes.
Just wanted to. No, I appreciate a lot sort of the presentation this evening, because it's kind of speaking a lot of things that I have, you know, that it's very encouraging that senior devotees are, you know, explaining the philosophy quite in a broad sense, and explaining about certain, you know, even the levels of Krishna consciousness that we're aspiring to get to. Because, like, I feel a little bit in the past, you know, if you mentioned anything about some of the higher levels of Krishna consciousness, oh no, we don't do that, or we stay away from that or something. So I just thought that was really good.
We're also trying to stay kinesthetic,
I just felt that I think it was delivered in a very, very, very nice way as well. So it kind of, it's very, very encouraging, like, you know, feel very comfortable about it. And
thank you.
There's one question from yesterday, or from, is it okay to kind of go back on yesterday?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, it's okay with everybody else.
It's just the and we're talking about it a little bit this morning, and it was the that whole idea about the soul and the soul experiencing suffering, and I remember, like, I meant to look it up before I came this evening, but I can vaguely remember in the discussion between Maharaj Raghunu and Maharaj Rahugana, that Rahugana, he would say that one of the points that he brought up was that,
yes,
you know, the body is suffering, and some of these people have to carry this load, and so therefore surely that the soul also suffers in that situation too. And Jadavar completely kind of dismissed it and says, no, there's only foolish people who will talk like that. But still, at the same time, we're talking about the spirit soul, he's illusioned. That's the idea, the spirit soul can be covered by illusion. And he also, is it that the spirit soul also is feeling the suffering as well? Or it's just, if you could
not really
speak any further on that one.
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in one sense, yes, but not really.
Yeah.
The soul's just witnessing.
Yeah.
So it's just, I'm going to go back to the same analogy. You know, you have a dream where something's happening in a dream.
But if he forgets he's witnessing, then he's an illusion.
Yes, that's the illusion. The illusion is that it's happening to me rather than that I'm witnessing it. And Krishna's illusion is so incredible that we really forget that we're witnessing. You know, if you're playing a computer game or you're reading a book or you're watching a film, there's some part of you that remembers that you're witnessing. But the way Krishna does it, we practically speaking forget. I mean, we remember, as I said, a little bit sometimes. We get a sense that, wait a minute, there's something funny going on here. Something's weird. I remember once when I took a nap at a time that I was fasting, so I wasn't. It was a day when I was not taking any food or water. I was very tired, so I rested for a little while. And in my dream, I had a big gallon jug of water, and I was pouring cup after cup after cup of water. And in my dream, you know, sometimes in a dream you have what's called a lucid dream. So all of a sudden there was a, I thought, this is weird. Why am I drinking all this water and I'm still thirsty? And immediately I woke up and realized I wasn't really drinking water. I was just dreaming I was drinking water. So occasionally in the human life, we think, why is it I'm doing all these things and I'm still not happy? That's the indicator that we're just the witness. If we were actually doing them, then we would be happy. They would satisfy us, but they don't. Because we're not doing them. It's something like if you take a photograph, you know, and there's a photo like they have in the advertisements for luxury cars or whatever, insurance, you know, you see in the magazine. So you take a photograph of a beautiful house and you're there with your beautiful family and you're there with your beautiful car and everybody's smiling and you look at the picture and say, see how happy I am. It's just mental concoction. You know, you do, I mean, if I'm reading a book or I'm watching a film, I become emotionally absorbed to the point that it's as if I'm actually there, almost. I mean, I experience that on a spiritual level a little bit. When we were watching the Ramayana with Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was just sitting right in front of me. And we were seeing a drama of the Ramayana, and it was at least a few moments when I felt like I was in the Dandaka Forest with Ram and Lakshman and Sita, rather than in New York City. So we all have experience doing that. We all have experience of becoming so emotionally transported to something that we're just witnessing that it feels like we're not just witnessing it anymore. And you can have physiological symptoms. People, you know, reading a book, watching a movie, they'll sweat and they'll shake and they'll laugh and they're right, as if they're experiencing. But they're not. They're just the witness. They're not really experiencing. And Krishna's just much better than any book writer or any filmmaker or any computer game creator. And he does it so it's almost total. It's not total, it's almost total. In human life, we get glimpses that there's something wrong. Which is one reason why in every human society there's legal forms of intoxicants. So when you have that glimmer, you know, hurry up, take something. Snuff it out. Yes?
Is it a bit worried about in the Chaitanya Charitamrita?
You're worried about it?
Well, you know, I'm worried about the concept. there's Vasudevdatta who's witnessing the witness's suffering, and he wants the suffering of the witness. In that concept of pure devotee, wouldn't he see that that suffering is actually Krishna's energy and not want to, wouldn't actually be witnessing the witness's suffering?
Yeah, but there is also an existential kind of suffering that's happening. So we're not experiencing the poverty and the disease and the insults and the aging and all that kind of stuff. That we're just witnessing to. But there is a kind of existential suffering that the soul is undergoing. Mm-hmm. And that's the suffering of feeling that we're separated from Krishna. Mm-hmm. And the great devotees, they want to relieve that kind of suffering. Now with Vasudev Dutt, see the problem is that as long as we're... Are you familiar with the game Monopoly?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody know the game Monopoly?
Yeah.
So you have all this play money, right? So the problem is, you can't just get away, you can't just get up and quit the game. You don't have to finish Monopoly games. There's no obligation, there's no moral obligation to finish a Monopoly game. Right? Sarva dharman pricha jamame kam sharanam raja ham tam sarva prapa yo moksha ikshami masu jaha. If you owe somebody money in a Monopoly game, you can just get up and walk away. You don't have to pay your debts. But most of us are not willing to just do that. Karna really had a problem with that. So basically Vasudev Dutt was saying, I'll pay all the Monopoly debt so that they can feel, okay, I'm done with that, and they can be liberated. So I see it like that. As long as we're absorbed in the reactions to our sins, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult to wake up to spiritual life. It's possible. I mean, Magrari and Valmiki, they both went directly from a sinful life to enlightenment, but that's very hard. So he was saying, you know, let me make it easy for them. Let me take on whatever. I'll deal with it and give them the opportunity for actual wakefulness. But I don't see that Vasudev Dutt was concerned about their illusory suffering. I see that he was concerned about their existential suffering. And he was going to take on their... He was going to remove the illusory thing to facilitate the real thing.
But the existential illusion can also be existential.
Well, the fact that you're an illusion
is your
existential suffering. But it's not that Vasudev Dutt was worried about, you know, somebody has an arm chopped off for it. That wasn't his worry. His concern was not, let me make the material situation nice for them. Although that is a concern of devotees who are in a position of political leaders. Mm-hmm. That's their job to do for Krishna, is to take care of the material side of people's happiness so there can be a peaceful society. So it's not that that's opposed, that having that concept of material welfare work is necessarily opposed to spiritual life. That's the business of the Kshatriyas in society. That's their service.
It's just that.
But that wasn't his mood.
It's just that I'm so it's under the impression that Yodhimadhukari, who would be Vasudevdatta, sees all Krishna's energy as saying he's going to be Mama Maya. It's my Maya. It's Krishna's Maya.
Yes. So many times the Uttamadhikari isn't actually concerned with even preaching. Because they see that everything is exactly how it's not only are they not concerned with the illusory suffering of, you know, somebody's in debt and somebody's in prison and somebody's in a war and that kind of thing. But somebody who's on the highest platform, otherwise how can anybody stay in the spiritual world and be with Krishna? You know, their mood is that whatever's happening is perfect, and that the people who aren't coming to Krishna consciousness is because they don't want to come to Krishna consciousness, and you know, which is generally Krishna's position. Krishna's position is neutral. He's just neutral. Whatever you want, I'll give you. I'll just respond to what you want, and I'm not going to impose on your freedom. You know, if you really want to be an illusion and you want to forget me, okay. And if you want to come to me, here I am, you know. But of course, there are some devotees who we say they come to a lower platform. What we mean by that, what I understand we mean by that, is just like when I'm teaching children how to read. So the way that a good reader reads is they read a whole phrase at a time by sight. And we only sound out words if it's a word that we're really not familiar with. And the only time we go back and look at individual words is if it's a word I'm not familiar with, or as if my predictions about the next phrase are wrong. So I read a phrase by sight, and I very quickly predict what the next phrase will be, and then if it's close to that, I read pretty seamlessly. And then I may have to go back sometimes. There was an attempt at some point to teach children to read like that from the beginning, which was an utter failure. And in the beginning, you have to teach children to sound out the words. You know, they have to go, it. They can't just read it. So when you're teaching children how to read, you have to remember what it's like to do things in a step-by-step fashion. And you have to articulate reading like that. You have to model reading like that. Same with mathematics. You know, once you're adept at mathematics, you do a number of intermediate steps automatically in your head without even knowing that you're doing them. And you just come to the answer. But when you're teaching somebody mathematics, you have to stop and think, now, what are the intermediate steps that I'm doing? How am I doing it? And you have to say that out loud and walk them through the steps. It's not that you lose your higher ability. It's not that you're actually functioning on that other platform. But in order to teach, you have to get to some extent into that mentality. So there are some great devotees who, for the purposes of serving Krishna, they adopt this other mentality of making distinctions. These people are devotees, these people are innocent, these people are demoniac. And they make a specific effort to try to help them. Because they know that although Krishna's neutral, that really he wants everybody to be happy. That's his desire. It's his principle that he doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity. We could talk about philosophically why that's true, but not tonight. So there's a principle why he doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity, but his desire is that everybody be happy. And just like if you're a parent, you know, once your child is 35 years old, hopefully, doesn't always happen, but hopefully you're no longer going to tell them what to wear. You know, when they're this age, you're not just going to tell her what to wear, you just put the clothes on. You don't ask her opinion. You don't say, do you really want to wear this lilac colored dress today? Just here it is. This is what we're putting on you. But at the same time, if your adult child is making a bad choice, you would like them to make a good choice. So you might not interfere. You might remain neutral. But in your heart, you're thinking, I really hope they make a good choice. So the devotees knowing that's how Krishna feels. Just like Krishna told Arjuna, I told you everything, now do whatever you want. And then right after that he says, Man mana bhava man bhakta. But please think of me. Yes.
I was having a discussion recently with a devotee on this question of soul. The soul is the seer. The soul is the witness. Is the observer. So I was making the point that why do we see illusion or why do we see reality? It's the same seer that's seeing. And the devotee was sort of countering this by saying that no, because the soul is so buried under the gross and subtle body that the soul is not seeing or is not hearing. And I couldn't really understand how he came to that conclusion, but I'm just wondering, could you say why, where's that coming from?
I don't think that's correct.
No, it's not
correct. I understand the soul is a witness. The soul is seeing.
Yeah, because the gross and subtle body is not sentient and
no.
Can't see or hear anything, so it has to be the soul that's seeing.
Definitely.
But I was kind of wondering, like, why would someone...
I don't know. You have to ask him. No, that's me.
You'd have to explain the context.
Maybe can you?
It's the real eyes are the eyes of the eyes of the soul.
Yeah. Yes.
The subtle eyes and the gross eyes. That's just a machine. Yeah, that can't. It has no capability of seeing anything. You can program a computer to say, you know, if Tadabhutu would use this example. You can program a computer with sensors that if there's a red light, the computer will type out, "I see a red light." But there's no conscious awareness. The conscious awareness is all in the soul. So all of the soul has senses. The soul has eyes and ears and nose and hands. And it's the spiritual senses that are actually active. But it's just coming through. Prabhupada talks about like a glove. Talks about like you're wearing a glove. So when you touch something with a glove, what's feeling is your hand, not the glove. The glove can't feel anything. You're feeling it through the glove. So the way you really feel is you take the glove off. Yes?
I think his idea was that the soul lends its consciousness to the false ego. And he wasn't exactly saying that the soul is not hearing, it's just giving another perspective.
Could be. You know, without having that person, it's not.
Like the conditioned soul is asleep to himself. It's not self-realized.
But even when you're asleep, though, it's the self who's seeing the dream.
Yes, it's the self who's seeing the dream.
Ultimately, but he wasn't denying that. I think you're misrepresenting.
I mean, you could, you know, the gross eyes have some facility, but the gross eye, you're not seeing anything. It's just a machine. I mean, it's a very clever machine. It's a pretty amazing machine. Even the gross body is an incredible machine, what to speak of the subtle body. It's such a machine that when you're inside of it, you can hardly distinguish it from yourself. Pretty amazing. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you for having me here in Dublin. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.